From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
How could a computer that is supposed to protect the votes of you and me count backwards to give a candidate negative votes? Either it was an error, or someone had tried to rig the election.
The election is a week away. Hacking Democracy. A new HBO documentary exposes the vulnerability of electronic voting machines. We'll speak with investigative reporter Bev Harris. Then vote suppression across the country. From new ID requirements to computerized voter lists, we take a look at how hundreds of thousands of eligible voters could be purged from the rolls. And we'll look at how third-party candidates are being increasingly marginalized. We'll go to Pennsylvania, which has some of the most restrictive ballot access laws in the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. With the midterm elections a week away, Vice President Dick Cheney has claimed anti-U.S. forces in Iraq have increased their attacks in order to influence the results of the election.
Whether it's al-Qaeda or the other elements that are active in Iraq, they are betting on the proposition they can break the will of the American people. They think we won't have the stomach for the fight long term. It's my belief that they're very sensitive to the fact that we've got an election scheduled. And, you know, they can get on the websites like anybody else. There isn't anything that's on the Internet that's not accessible to them. They're on it all the time. They're very sophisticated users of it.
The vice president offered no evidence to back up his assertion. On Monday, President Bush said the terrorists will win if the Democrats succeed in next week's election. At a campaign rally in Georgia, Bush said, quote, "The Democrat approach in Iraq comes down to this. The terrorists win and America loses. That's what's at stake in this election." Meanwhile, the bloodshed continues in Iraq. At least 81 people died across the country on Monday. The death toll from the massive bombing in Sadr City has increased to 33. Shiite militants called for a general strike in Sadr City, which has been under a U.S. siege for almost a week. This comes as the United States is increasing the number of troops on the ground. There are now 150,000 troops inside Iraq, the largest number since January. In Mexico, over 10,000 protesters demonstrated in Oaxaca Monday, calling for the removal of federal police from the city and the resignation of Oaxaca Governor Ulises Ruiz. Over the weekend, Mexican President Vicente Fox sent in thousands of special police into the city, but the nonviolent resistance movement remains in control of much of Oaxaca. The Zapatistas have called for roadblocks on Wednesday throughout Chiapas to show solidarity with the people of Oaxaca. They're also encouraging others to stage roadblocks throughout Mexico and the United States. In addition, the Zapatistas called for a nationwide shutdown on November 20th. Meanwhile, Mexico's Senate and House have urged Ruiz to resign. This is Mexican Congressmember Javier González Garza.
La Cámara de Diputados exhorta.
The House of Representatives urges the governor of the state of Oaxaca, Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, to resign in the interest of reestablishing governability, judicial order, and peace in the state.
Back in this country, in Washington, the State Department has indicated it's not going to press the Mexican government over the murder of American journalist Brad Will. He was shot dead Friday by Mexican gunmen tied to the government. He died with his video camera in his hand. This is State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick.
Anytime you have resort to violence which results in the death of a citizen, whether it's an American or any other nationality, that's a source of concern. But that is really going to be up to the Mexican government to deal with how they deal with this. I understand this originally started out as a series of protests. They turned violent, and the Mexican authorities are dealing with them.
The State Department spokesperson was later asked whether the Bush administration would demand the Mexican government investigate who's responsible for the murder of Brad Will. McCormick claimed the State Department's not aware that anyone linked to Will's death has been identified. However, the Mexican press has published a photograph taken at the scene showing the armed men. They've been identified as Juan Carlos Soriano, Manuel Aguilar, Abel Santiago Zarate, and Pedro Carmona. All four men are connected to the local government. They're reportedly now in custody. In New York, hundreds of friends and supporters of the slain journalist Brad Will blockaded the entrance to the Mexican consulate for over an hour Monday. 12 people were arrested, including a Reuters photographer. 9 of them were held overnight. Brad Wills' former roommate and fellow indie media journalist, Brandon Jordan, was arrested after he lay down in the street while wearing a shirt covered in red ink depicting where Brad was shot. Protests took place in at least 13 other U.S. cities. This is Father Frank Morales.
If anything, what Brad's death is going to do is to force us to step it up. And we're going to step it up, and in Brad's memory, because Brad, he may be absent, but he's present. And, you know, I'm angry. And I know a lot of people are angry. And, you know, we're just not going to go for this. Yeah. This is over. If we have to go directly to Oaxaca ourselves, we're going to bring thousands of people down there. We're going to take back. We're going to make some justice here.
In Pakistan, a mass funeral was held Monday for up to 80 people that were killed in an airstrike at a religious school near the Afghan border. The Pakistani government has said its own military helicopters carried out the attack. But ABC News is reporting the bombing was actually carried out by a U.S. Predator drone. Sources tell ABC Al-Qaeda's Ayman al-Zawahiri was the intended target. Pakistan's denying the ABC report, but has admitted it relied on U.S. intelligence to carry out the bombing. In Chile, a federal judge has placed the former dictator Augusto Pinochet under house arrest. This comes 3 days after torture and kidnapping charges were filed against him. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad warned the United Nations not to impose sanctions over its disputed nuclear program. He said Iran would respond with a, quote, appropriate and firm response to any U.N. sanctions. Iran's deputy U.N. ambassador, Mehdi Danesh Yazdi, has criticized the international community for its stance on Israel and its secret nuclear weapons program.
The Israeli regime is allowed to acquire a large stockpile of nuclear weapons in the volatile Middle East region and defy the will of all regional states and the international community to turn the Middle East into a zone free from nuclear weapons.
A top United Nations expert on human rights says the new U.S. Military Commissions Act violates international treaties protecting detainees. The official, Martin Scheinen, said one of the most serious aspects of the law is the power of the president to declare anyone, including U.S. citizens, without charge as an unlawful enemy combatant. Scheinen also deplored the denial of the habeas corpus rights of foreigners, including legal permanent U.S. residents, to challenge the legality of their detention. He said this is in contradiction with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, a treaty the U.S. ratified in 1992. In Britain, Tony Blair's government has launched a new initiative to fight global warming. The British government issued a major report Monday that says global warming will have a cataclysmic effect on the global economy. British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
What is not in doubt is that the scientific evidence of global warming caused by greenhouse gas emissions is now overwhelming. It is not in doubt that if the science is right, the consequences for our planet are literally disastrous. And this disaster is not set to happen in some science fiction future many years ahead, but in our lifetime.
British Chancellor Gordon Brown outlined the government's plan of action.
Our proposal is to set a new European-wide emissions reduction target of 30% by 2020, then at least 60% by 2050. Providing greater long-term certainty for business as we extend the framework for four more decades. Our proposal is also to expand it to cover more sectors and more emissions, to take it beyond carbon dioxide to other greenhouse gases, and then to extend it from Europe across the world.
Prime Minister Tony Blair said the consequences of inaction are literally disastrous for the planet, but he said other nations must step up.
We have got to ensure that there is a framework that America will come into and China and India. Because the reality of this is, unless you get those three actors in this framework, it isn't going to succeed.
Meanwhile, a new report from the United Nations has found the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from the industrialized world is growing again, despite the Kyoto Protocol. In media news, journalists at two TV stations in Maine have been ordered not to cover stories related to global warming. The policy affects both the ABC and Fox affiliates in Bangor, Maine. Michael Palmer, the general manager of the station, said in a memo, when, quote, Bar Harbor is underwater, then we can do global warming stories. Until then, no more. Palmer said he placed global warming stories in the same category as the killer African bee scare from the 1970s or the Y2K scare. The Israeli cabinet approved by a large majority Monday the appointment of Avigdor Lieberman to become deputy prime minister and strategic threats minister. Lieberman's a far right-wing politician who's called for Arabs living in Israel to be transferred to the Palestinian territories. Ahmed Tibi, a Palestinian member of the Knesset, criticized the move.
We are talking about black day for the Israeli democracy. Lieberman, fascist number one of the Israeli society, of Israel, the parallel of Le Pen and Jörg Haider, is being upgraded to the degree of deputy prime minister. It's a message sent by Mr. Olmert to the Arab minority, to the region, about his direction and about his feeling towards Arab citizens of the state of Israel.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Bush administration's undertaken efforts to arm and train the Presidential Guard of Palestinian Authority Chair Mahmoud Abbas in order to prepare it for a potential violent confrontation with Hamas. Palestinian sources say the training started in August under the guidance of an American military instructor. The training's occurring at a compound in Jericho where reporters were recently barred access. And in Bolivia, President Evo Morales has secured a major victory after foreign energy companies agreed to stay in the country and share a larger share of their profits with the state of Bolivia. Morales campaigned for president on a platform of partially nationalizing Bolivia's energy resources. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There's a week to go before millions of voters cast their votes in the midterm elections. Many are calling this the most high-stakes election in recent years, with the possibility of a Democratic takeover of Congress. But since the contested presidential elections of 2000 and 2004, more people have been raising concerns about the integrity of our voting system. Today, we spend the hour looking at the state of voting in this country. We start by looking at electronic voting machines. There have been widespread reports of malfunctions and security lapses, even though these machines count 80% of the votes cast in America today. Last month, Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich called for the state to scrap its electronic voting system and revert to paper ballots in the upcoming election. He cited technical glitches that occurred during Maryland's primary election. In that election, electronic voting machines that were built by Diebold Corporation repeatedly crashed. Ehrlich said the voting situation is, quote, approaching crisis proportions. But the problem is not limited to Maryland. A report released earlier this year by the group Common Cause found Maryland was only one of 17 states nationwide whose voting system is at high risk for a compromised election. Well, a new documentary airing on HBO on November 2nd exposes the vulnerability of computers that are counting our votes. The film follows Bev Harris, a Seattle grandmother and writer, as she investigates the security and accuracy of electronic voting systems. Her investigation takes her from the trash cans of Texas to the Secretary of State of California and finally to Florida. We'll talk to Bev Harris in a minute. But first, we go to an excerpt of the documentary Hacking Democracy. This clip looks at a faulty vote tally from the 2000 presidential election in Volusia County, Florida.
As dusk fell on election night, one official noticed something very strange, a sign that the heart of America's democracy was in danger. In Volusia County, Florida, an election computer counted Al Gore's totals backwards. He had negative votes.
It was showing a minus sign in front of the votes that it had subtracted from Gore. I mean, it wasn't like it was trying to hide it. It says there's minus 16,022 votes here.
How could a computer that is supposed to protect the votes of you and me count backwards to give a candidate negative votes? Either it was an error, or someone had tried to rig the election.
Hacking Democracy will air on HBO on November 2nd. Bev Harris joins us now in New York, author of Black Box Voting. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's nice to be here.
So how did that happen in Volusia County, Florida?
Actually, according to internal memos, it was a replacement ballot box. A ballot box nowadays is the size of a credit card. It's electronic, but They replaced it, and the offending ballot box is now missing.
How did you get interested in this whole issue?
Well, you know, I'd read that the voting machines were using secret proprietary software, and so I wanted to find out who owned the companies. And as I looked into that, I discovered a Republican senator from Nebraska who was running for office had ownership in the company that was counting his own votes. That's Chuck Hagel. I couldn't go to sleep that night. I never intended to get into this, but, you know, one question leads to the next. And in this situation, every answer is the wrong answer.
And so as you've conducted this investigation, how long has it been now when you couldn't sleep that night?
4 years.
What have you found about the electronic voting machines of this country? HBO, in this documentary that they're going to be airing November 2nd, just followed you around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they followed me around for, well, it wasn't HBO, it was two British gentlemen, Simon Ardizzone and Russell Michaels. And after about 3 years, they caught all kinds of interesting things on camera that is really quite amazing, which is why we're recommending citizens go out with video cameras this November. But we found that not only are the machines error-prone, they're also tamper-friendly, and that the companies that make them are in cover-up mode.
Tamper-friendly?
Yes. They seem to be built for tampering. I can tamper with it. How sad is that? I'm not a computer scientist.
How can you tamper with it?
Well, they actually have multiple points where you can go in and insert something or alter something. And interestingly, there's been many studies now, both from ordinary citizens and from computer scientists and universities. All of them have been able to penetrate the systems and manipulate elections, and all of them use different attack points. So, you know, when you have a complicated system, there's a lot of failure points and there's a lot of attack points. It's not just one.
Talk about election protection, what you just said. Well, you can just go out with a video camera. What exactly do you mean?
Well, one of the things we found in 2004 is that terrible things happen in elections, and if you come back and tell a story about it, it's very difficult to enact change. It's very difficult to get the media to cover it. However, if you get videotape of the problem, if we all remember Rodney King, if that beating had happened and there was no video, very little would have ever been said about that. We need to get the kind of documentary evidence, the citizenry needs to get it, to prove this case. And we need to get evidence in the form that it can't be spun or explained away. And the two best kinds of evidence available to us are videotape and public records.
Well, what do you mean by videotape? Because if you're talking about electronic voting machines, and what's the percentage now? What, three-quarters of votes are counted on electronic voting machines?
Right. Computerized voting machines, actually it's up to almost 90% of the vote. And remember, computerized voting doesn't have to be a touch screen. It can be any votes that go into a computer. People are surprised to know that even absentee votes, once they get to the elections office, go straight into a computer. And it is at about 90% now.
So how do you film if a computer is hacked? I mean, it doesn't help when you walk in with your little camera.
Well, you can get a lot of things. For example, you can imagine in 2004 when they said that this election office was shut down due to Homeland Security reasons, which was bogus. If somebody had had a video camera, that would have been very helpful. We're seeing situations every day now where somebody, if they just had a video camera, there, for example, error messages showing up on the central tabulator that are really scary, saying things like, I can't connect to the network anymore. You know, I just lost my connection. And the public records, I can't emphasize enough how important they are. In San Diego, in the June 6th election, the event log, the audit log that was obtained by a citizen named Bruce Sims, shows the voting machine dialing out to Diebold at 9:31 p.m. during the count on election night. These are the kinds of things that show up.
Wait, also, explain that.
Yes. It's
what do
difficult
you mean
to
the
explain.
Machine dialing out?
The machine dialed out and made a remote connection to Diebold at 9:31 p.m. during the count. And when you say explain it, I don't know of any legitimate explanation.
So what happened in that case?
Interestingly enough, as we find citizens out there gathering these, public officials are, in many cases, and San Diego is one, not following the law, not following the regulations. The first thing we have to do is find out if they even are following them. They aren't there. And then we need to take action to enforce the law and get them taken out of office. It's very difficult because there's very little will to enforce, and there are very few consequences for election officials who fail to follow the law.
The significance of Governor Ehrlich saying no electronic voting machines in Maryland?
Very interesting. And we are noticing, I know everybody wants to say this is Republicans against Democrats and so forth, but we are noticing that in the states with touchscreen voting where the Democrats are in control, it is the Republicans that are calling for paper. That's the case in Georgia, in Maryland, and in my state, in Washington state.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center for Justice, and we'll go to Columbus, Ohio, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for more election coverage. Stay with us.
Mark your ballots in the light. Count them all by hand. Oh, get your piece of paper and a pencil and a pen and mark them down by hand. Mark your ballots on a piece of paper and count them all by hand. On that day, on that great the only way to count them right is to count them all by hand. Count them every one by hand. Yes, count them all by hand, Lordy. The only way to count them right is to count them all by hand. On that day, on that great election day.
Woo, look out.
Cause who's gonna be the master? Who's gonna be the slave? Who's gonna be the master? Gonna be the slave, and who's gonna be the master, and who's gonna be the slave on that day, on that great election day.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That song, Great Election Day by Butch Hancock. I'm Amy Goodman. It's not just electronic voting machines that are raising concerns. Experts say new computerized voter lists and new rules regarding voter registration and ID requirements have the potential to disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters. The Brennan Center for Justice has a new report detailing the ways in which the vote could be suppressed in several states next week. In an op-ed piece published in the New York Times Monday, they write some of the new rule changes are, quote, engineered by mischievous partisans who've passed laws and rules that would block many eligible citizens from voting. Wendy Weiser is the deputy director of the Democracy Program at Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. She joins Bev Harris in our Firehouse studio. We welcome you as well. Talk about this study and the states and what you're finding.
Well, unfortunately, over the past 2 years, we've seen a host of new rules being passed in states across the country that will actually make it a lot harder for many citizens to vote. In some cases, it's creating a virtual obstacle course for voters. For example, one new set of rules that we've seen is in response to the record increases in voter registration in 2004 with the assistance of nonpartisan voter registration groups, a number of states have passed laws that actually, rather than praising the groups, crack down on their activities and expose them to criminal sanctions for often very harmless mistakes or things that make no difference to the integrity of the
election.
Give us
examples.
Well, for example, in Ohio, the state had a rule that would have subjected volunteers to criminal penalties if they turned in voter registration forms they collected to the supervisor of a voter registration drive to turn in, rather than personally going to the elections office themselves to turn in the voter registration forms. And they would have been, that would have been a criminal penalty for civic volunteer activity.
And who passes this?
Well, it's been passed by legislatures. In some cases, it's rules developed by secretaries of states. And it's really having a chilling effect on voter registration drives, and other rules are having a chilling effect on a lot of voters as well.
How about Pennsylvania?
Well, in Pennsylvania, there was an effort to push a serious photo ID requirement that actually was rebuffed and in fact, was vetoed. And so Pennsylvania was saved from that onerous burden that now exists in other states, most notably Indiana. A number of courts have actually found that this is unconstitutional.
Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. First, the kinds of IDs that these laws are requiring, it's a very limited form of ID. It's not just show who you are, who you say you are. It's actually you have to have one specific form of document that many citizens don't have, and that also costs money. So courts say that it's been an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote, and it's a poll tax. Some of these documents could cost up to $45. For proof of citizenship, naturalized citizen papers could cost over $200.
Colorado?
Colorado has passed some serious voter registration restrictions that have made it very hard for voter registration groups to register voters.
How?
For example, it's a criminal penalty to use the federally approved voter registration form instead of the form that a special form that the Secretary of State approves, and they have other restrictions.
It's a crime to use a federally approved form.
That's right. The courts have not considered this yet, but under the new law, if you want to do a voter registration drive, you have to use a special form developed by the Secretary of State for voter registration drives, not the universal form that has been approved by the federal government for use nationwide.
Florida?
Florida has had a host of new restrictions. They, too, have cracked down on voter registration drives, so much so that the League of Women Voters of Florida was forced to actually shut down their voter registration drives for the first time in 70 years. They have some new onerous ID requirements. Florida citizens should know that they're actually their ballots should count, even if they don't have photo ID, if their signature matches the signature on the voter registration form. Unfortunately, the Secretary of State has not made this clear, and there's a lot of confusion. So a lot of Floridians that don't have photo IDs, and a lot of elderly voters, for example, don't have driver's licenses, might end up disenfranchised, even though their votes should count under Florida law.
And is that only Florida, the issue of signatures?
The issue of signature matching is something that is used in a variety of states as an alternative to identification requirements. The Florida is unique in that it has a photo identification requirement, which could be overcome by voters if their signatures match.
Uh-huh. South Dakota?
South Dakota is one of a few states that actually have passed a really serious barrier to voting using their new computerized statewide voter registration lists. And what South Dakota is doing is it's requiring the information on your voter registration application to match exactly, through a computer match process, information on other lists like driver's license or Social Security lists. And while that might sound reasonable, in reality, up to 20 or 30% of eligible voters might not match because these processes don't work well. Typos, other maiden names, a lot of common glitches mean that eligible voters will not match and will be excluded from the voter registration list for no good reason.
Texas?
Texas has that exact same rule. We understand that they are reconsidering it, but a lot of voters have been barred from the rolls because of that rule as well.
How is it happening in Arizona?
Arizona recently passed a very onerous identification requirement, and in particular, they're requiring citizens to provide proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. And many citizens register to vote online. Proof of citizenship is something that a lot of people don't have, even when they think they have it, to have a valid birth certificate or a passport, which only 25 or 27% of citizens have, is something that not a lot of people can do. And this has already had a significant effect. The state's largest counties earlier reported that they were rejecting up to 17% of registrations. Something like 22,000 of people that tried to register to vote this year were turned away. So it's had a real serious impact in keeping registration rates down.
We're talking to Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center, based at New York University. We're also joined by Bev Harris. You mentioned Ohio. I want to go there right now as well. On Sunday in Ohio, a judge put on hold a decision that suspended the state's new voter identification law. Our next two guests write that this law imposes a series of draconian requirements for voter ID, including the demand for certain documents. These documents are more difficult to obtain by the poor, people who are homeless or elderly, all constituents who tend to vote Democratic. Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman are now with us in studio in Columbus, Ohio. Bob Fetrakis, a political science professor at Columbus State Community College and an independent candidate for governor. Harvey Wasserman is an independent journalist based in Columbus, senior editor for freepress.org. Bob and Harvey co-authored the book What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. And you can find their latest article on the Free Press website. That's called Will a Shocking New GOP Court Victory and Karl Rove's Attack on Ohio in 2006 Doom the Democrats Nationwide? Well, let me put that question to Harvey Wasserman. Will it?
It very well could. There's this whole anticipation that the Democrats are about to retake at least the House, possibly the Senate as well. We think there's tremendous manipulation going on. We know there's tremendous manipulation going on here in Ohio. We have J. Kenneth Blackwell as the Secretary of State running an election in which he is also running as, for governor. And the state Republican apparatus has done everything in its power to limit the franchise in this state, make it more difficult for alleged Democrats, put it that way, to vote. They have imposed tremendous problems for people wishing to vote. They've decimated the voter registration campaign, and we think the polls are probably not reflecting the fact that many, many people who are expecting to vote on Election Day are not going to be able to vote because of the terrible restrictions that have been put in place by the Republican Party here, with very clear goals as to limiting the Democratic vote.
Explain, though, exactly why you see this as Karl Rove's attack on Ohio.
Well, we don't think that this could be coming strictly from the State House here. Karl Rove and George W. Bush were in Columbus on Election Day 2004. We are dead certain that that election in 2004 was stolen. We watched it here on the ground in Ohio from the start. We have put out a book with 100 different ways that the election was stolen here, and we now have a book of documents with the New Press, what happened in Ohio in 2004, and we're watching it unfold again in 2006.
Well, wait, how do you know... That for sure it was stolen. Give us some examples that back up your argument.
Well, we actually have successfully sued now to preserve the ballots from 2004. The initial inspection of the ballots at some of the 88 counties in Ohio indicates very clear irregularities, theft, and just general manipulation. And we have gone through the we've looked at the electronic voting machines. We've looked at the long lines that occurred.
We can be very specific. We found 22,000 overvotes in a non-random pattern. Yeah, they're all in heavily Democratic districts, and they're not on the paper form with absentees. And we also had pre-punched paper ballot reports sworn under oath. So what we're finding in areas like Cleveland, Akron, Toledo, areas that went 12-1 for Kerry, 7-1 for Kerry, 5-1 for Kerry, a statistically improbable ratio of overvotes for the president, which probably cost the president John Kerry 22,000 votes. We're also finding that they purged between 2000 and 2004, they purged 24.93% of all the voters in Cleveland, which voted 83% for Kerry in that city.
What do you mean they purged them?
They purged them. It's a May clause. They didn't have to purge. The Board of Election purged nearly a quarter of the voters in the city of Cleveland. 8,000 to 10,000 were purged accidentally by Diebold in what they call an electronic glitch. But all of these are in heavily Democratic areas. 28,000 people were purged in Toledo in 2004. In Ohio, boards of elections only purge in odd number years, 2001, 2003.
Well, Bob Fetrakis,
just to follow up on this point, you said Diebold accidentally purged them. Explain exactly what you're talking about, because you're doing this research for a number of years now. Most people in this country, this is all new information for.
Well, what we're moving to across the country, which is really quite scary, is electronic poll books. And when they converted the old system, the old computer system, to the new electronic poll books, 8,000 to 10,000 names were, quote, accidentally glitched. That is, people eligible to vote, their names were simply left off and they were turned away.
Right. We have in Ohio now, since 2000, we have clear testimony that 500,000, roughly 500,000 voters have been dropped from the voter list in heavily Democratic areas in Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, and Toledo. 500,000 voters is nearly 10% of the entire electorate in the state of Ohio. 5.6 million people voted in Ohio or had their votes counted in Ohio, let's put it that way, in 2004. And going into the 2006 election, 500,000 people have been purged from the registration rolls that we know of, and they are all in Democratic areas. We have no evidence of purges in Republican areas.
Well, not only that, in Republican areas, Miami County, which is only 2% African-American, they're on the record. The director, Steve Quillen, they're a, quote, no-purge county. And as a result of that, they had a 98.55% voter turnout in one precinct. Although when we showed up to audit that precinct, instead of finding 679 out of 689 voters having voted, we only found 547 signatures in the book, which was about 82%. So we're finding massive irregularities. And this occurred on election eve as well. In Clyde, Ohio, they said 131% voter turnout on election eve. What we found is that in many of the rural counties in Ohio, they ran the absentees through twice, which gave President Bush a tremendous boost in these counties.
Right, and even with preliminary investigation, we found one precinct where allegedly more than 350 consecutive voters cast a ballot for George W. Bush. We've also found a precinct where there were more than 50 consecutive replacement ballots, allegedly spoiled ballots replaced by poll workers. It is very, very clear what happened in 2004, and we fear it's going to happen again in 2006.
Do you think Ohio is unusual? I mean, it was clearly key. And remind us, how important was Ohio in the national election?
Ohio decided the 2004 election. We believe that we are pretty certain that there was a clear campaign to guarantee that under any circumstances, George W. Bush would win Ohio. The president, the CEO of Diebold, Wally Odell, in the year prior to the election, sent out a fundraising letter saying he was going to guarantee that Ohio's electoral votes would go to George W. Bush. This is a little fishy coming from the guy who's in charge of the Diebold Corporation, were cast and counted a substantial percentage of the votes here in Ohio.
And he also was a member of the president's Pioneer and Ranger team, was at the Crawford Ranch, raised $200,000 for the president. But even more interesting, a group called the Mighty Texas Strike Force showed up 2 weeks in advance, stayed at the Holiday Inn. We have affidavit on this from a Republican night clerk there who actually turned him in. They were data mining. They seemed to know, and they were using payphones only, who owned parking tickets, who was behind on their child support, who had traffic tickets, and they were caught making phone calls telling people if they showed up at the polls, they would be arrested. They were also calling people on probation and making the same threats. When we contacted the Mighty Texas Strike Force through the Free Press, and inquired about who they were, they proudly said that they were linked to the White House and Karl Rove, and proudly bragged about their role. Also, flyers went up everywhere telling people they were illegally registered and that Democrats had to vote on Wednesday and Republicans on Tuesday.
All
this is in the book.
You have to remember that the 2004 election was run by J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio, who simultaneously served as the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign. And the 2006 election is being run by the same man who is now a GOP candidate for governor here. This gives new dimension to the term conflict of interest. There is no way that the Republican Party would have carried Ohio in 2004 with a fair election. It did not happen. And we're very much afraid that many of the key U.S. Senate race and many of the key House races in Ohio in 2006 are going to be subject to fraud, and that the Democrats, the people who think that the Democrats are going to do well in this election, may well be sorely disappointed.
There's already 5,000 voters in Franklin County here in Columbus, that their absentee ballots won't be counted because we've gone to the photo ID with the driver's license. There's two different numbers on there. There's an administrative identifier over the picture, which is actually bigger than the driver's license, and at least 5,000 people used that number, and now we're being told by the Secretary of State's office that their votes won't be counted, which is part of what's going on in the current lawsuit that you were speaking of earlier.
Right. What the Republicans have done here is injected tremendous confusion. We had a four-day period recently, within the last week or two, where the rules for voting in Ohio changed three times in 4 days. And we have intrusion into the federal court system and tremendous confusion being created at the 88 county boards of elections where nobody really has a firm take on what's required to cast a ballot in Ohio. We think this is deliberate. It's classic Rove strategy, and the stakes here couldn't be higher. And we are very concerned about what's going to happen. We are urging people to videotape. We will hold hearings after the election where people can be sworn in, as we did in 2004. This has all got to be documented, or we're going to be in dire straits in terms of preserving our democracy in this country.
Harvey Wasserman, I'm curious about what you think of this latest story of the Committee on Foreign Investment investigating that Smartmatic, whose chief principals are Venezuelan entrepreneurs, last year purchased Sequoia voting systems, which makes the equipment used in Florida counties like Pinellas and Hillsborough elections. This is the same government committee that investigated the ownership of the U.S. ports by Dubai. How significant is this?
Very significant. The voting machines on which 80%, as you've said, of the ballots in this country are cast or counted are all controlled by Republicans. Diebold is a Republican corporation. ENSNS, of course, has Chuck Hagel as a principal, a senator from Nebraska, where he's been elected twice on machines that that he owns. We have a distinct aroma here of a third world country being manipulated by the Central Intelligence Agency, as was done under George H.W. Bush the first year. We're starting to feel in this country, and especially in this state, as if we're being treated like a third world country where our elections are manipulated and up for grabs. People are being eliminated from the voter rolls. As you know, in 2004, we had tremendously long lines in very specifically targeted African-American precincts and in liberal student precincts at Kenyon College and at Oberlin College, and we see this happening again. There is no accident here. This confusion entered in with the voting machines and with the electronic poll books is very, very deliberate. And the Republicans are already talking about polls that the public doesn't know about. Those polls are linked to their ability to manipulate and to steal elections. The 2004 election was stolen here in Ohio, and we're afraid it's about to happen again in 2006. And we're not sure that the public is really prepared to deal with tracking this down. We think there's been improvement. We think the word has spread, especially through your show and through the internet, but people have to be sworn in. Sworn testimony has to be given after this election. There have to be very detailed records, even in places where we don't think there's a problem, because there is a problem, and the people in Washington are in the White House are very clear on what they're doing. They've been practicing for a long, long time, and this has to be stopped, or we are not going to have anything resembling a democracy in this country.
Harvey, another concern is...
Bob, we just have about 20 seconds. Go ahead.
The other problem is the privatization of the voter registration rolls. What we found from a quick survey is many of the counties have turned over the voter registration rolls to Republican-controlled or connected firms like Triad, ESNS, and Diebold. So a lot of people could show up on Election Day and find that they've been purged.
Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Their book is called What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. We will continue to follow the story, of course. They were joining us from Columbus, Ohio. And as we wrap up this segment, before we move to Pennsylvania, I wanted to ask you both, Beb Harris and Wendy Weiser, about how people can stop voter suppression or make sure their votes are counted. Let me start with Wendy.
Well, the very first thing that all Americans can do is go vote next Tuesday. The best defense is a good offense.
But people who are just listening to this today might just say, why is it worth it?
Well, it is worth it because it's important to send a message that Americans care about their democracy, care about voting, and want to live in the kind of democracy where people are not turned away from the polls. People should insist that they can cast a ballot and that their ballot count. And if they do experience, regardless of what people tell them, and if they do experience problems, there are a lot of nonpartisan organizations that could help them. There are voter hotlines like 1-866-OUR-VOTE that anyone can call from around the country to get assistance from nonpartisan groups about how to overcome any problem they might be experiencing at the polls and to cast a vote that can count.
But how do people even do this? They race to the poll before work. You're already in a long line. You don't have time for this. Then you're turned away. There's nothing you can do. You've waited on a long line, and then you have to go to work. How do you deal with this? Do you have to spend the day challenging?
Well, I have no doubt that in places where there are really long lines that there will be court challenges to keep the polls open later in the evening so people can come back after work if they can't make it. But people should, you know, try and vote and do what they can to get through those lines and call in problems. The election officials can try to fix the long lines by bringing in more supplies if the problems are reported.
So our vote is one. Bev Harris?
Well, we say propagate the information to at least five places to make sure it gets out. And now is the time to go on the offense, not retreat. By go on the offense, I mean go vote and then go find out what happened to your vote. And you may run into a brick wall and you may find a public officials making it up as they go.
Wait,
that's
what
important.
Do you mean? You have to find out what happened to your vote.
Well, go look for the records, bring a camera with you. If you're stuck in a line, videotape the line and then get it to the news media, get it to the blogs, get it to at least five different places. Propagate the information. It's very important because we have to take this back. We are literally losing our democracy. And if we don't go out there and take it back, it's not going to be done for us.
I mean, long lines. You go to the poll in the morning, 6 or 7 in the morning, and it's standard that you wait for about an hour.
Well,
should it
six
be?
Or 7 hours, it's not standard, though. Waiting in the rain, in the cold, for 6 hours, as they did in, and 9 hours, as they did in Ohio in 2004, is not standard. And thank goodness that was captured on videotape. That was one of the few things that was captured on videotape. Had that not happened, it would just be a story. We've got to go out there and take this back.
Can you take your video camera into the polling booth?
It depends on the location. You certainly can't do anything that would compromise anyone else's privacy. But there have been now, in fact, in the Hacking Democracy HBO special, there is actually very rare footage of a voting machine flipping votes, where a candidate is trying to vote for herself, and it keeps going up, coming up for the other candidate. And this happens from machine to machine to machine. So
where was
she? Got it. This was in New Orleans. So, and
before
it was a Republican candidate.
Before Hurricane Katrina.
Before. So, in fact, this candidate videotaped this. They had the very first touchscreens in the nation. And so this has been going on for a long time. She's been trying to get this story out for 10 years. But this is an example of why it's so important. She's been trying to get the story up for 10 years, and it is now going on to HBO. At least she had the video.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We will certainly link to your websites. Bev Harris, the documentary Hacking Democracy will air on November 2nd
at
on
9
HBO,
p.m.
9 p.m. around the country. Wendy Weiser, your report we will link to at the Brennan Center, which is based at New York University. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! DemocracyNow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Your best friend, help you the way you can. Man, take his feature, just run the way. Careful how you vote on election day. Not the one you vote for,
Sunnyland Slim. Be careful how you vote here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the battle between Republicans and Democrats for control of Congress dominates the country's attention, independent and third-party candidates are being increasingly marginalized, both in the media and at the polls. Nowhere is this more true than in Pennsylvania. Due to the state's restrictive ballot access laws, Pennsylvania will be one of only four states having statewide races without any independent or third-party candidates. The senatorial race pits incumbent Republican Rick Santorum on the ballot against Democrat Bob Casey. It was relatively easy for either major party candidate to get his name on the statewide ballot. They needed just 2,000 signatures each on their nominating petitions. By contrast, any other candidate this year needed over 30 times that much, or about 67,000 signatures. Carl Romanelli is the Green Party candidate who had hoped to run against Casey and Santorum. His name will not appear on the ballot next week. Romanelli is among the speakers at a forum tonight for statewide write-in candidates held by the Pennsylvania Ballot Access Coalition. Carl Romanelli joins us now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where the meeting's going to take place tonight. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carl.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
How hard is it to get on the ballot?
Oh, it's nearly impossible. We believe that we met the impossible, filed a signature filing that was not only historic in its volume, but was historic in its integrity and its credibility. And after an arduous 8.5 weeks, the only way I was able to be displaced from the ballot was by having the court case climax in my not being allowed to present my evidence, testimony, and defense. Because our signatures are fine, they're perfectly valid, and the discrepancies between what the Casey camp is saying and what we're saying regarding validity is a problem with the statewide computer system and how information is gotten out of it, not a problem with our filing. So when you jump through the hoops and you accomplish the impossible, and then find yourself displaced anyway, it has chilling implications for democracy, as some of the other information previously mentioned on your show does.
Who challenged your signatures?
It was challenged by the Democratic Party, but it was a clear attempt on the part of Bob Casey to make sure that I went away. The Democrats like to use this line that I would be a spoiler. But I suspect that deep down it's because Bob Casey was petrified to debate me. Bob Casey's from my section of the state. We've known each other for a while, and he knows that I'm much more well-informed policy-wise as well as a much more capable debater.
Carl Romanelli, the funding of your campaign is something I'd like to address right now, coming from this unlikely source, prominent Republicans. Last week, we interviewed journalist Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Daily News, who reported on the issue. Let's take a listen to what he said.
The Green Party of Pennsylvania obviously doesn't have $100,000, but lo and behold, they got $100,000, and the way they did that was through an effort that was totally 100%, not even 99%, but 100% funded by conservatives and Republicans, most of whom either have a history of directly supporting Rick Santorum, the Republican candidate in the Senate race here in Pennsylvania, or supporting causes that are close to Rick Santorum, either opposing abortion rights or that sort of thing. So we have a situation here where, and as it turned out, even in spite of all of that, and in spite of spending $100,000 on a company that with Republican roots that's very controversial that helped them try to get on the ballot, in the end they still didn't have enough signatures. And in fact, Carl Romanelli, barring a last minute, he may have one appeal still out there, but I'm 99.9% sure Carl Romanelli will not be on the ballot next month. It's kind of disturbing. I mean, voters want choice here, but I mean, clearly the entire Green Party candidacy here ended up being a motivator to get liberal voters. As some of your listeners may know, that the Democratic candidate we have here in Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, is one of the more conservative Democrats out there. He's anti-abortion. He supports some NRA positions, that sort of thing. And, you know, some progressive voters would want to go for somebody with the Green Party if there was a legitimate Green Party candidate. This was not a legitimate campaign by any means. This was an attempt to divert votes from Bob Casey and help one of the most conservative Republicans in the country, Rick Santorum, get reelected.
Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Daily News. We don't have much time, Carl Romanelli, but getting money from Eric Prince, head of Blackwater, and a top aide to Frist, and a lobbyist for Halliburton, your explanation?
Yes. Well, the bottom line is that I needed money. I have been trying to fundraise for the Greens for 5 years, and Democrats and progressives just aren't giving us any. It was my intention to elevate the level of discourse on the issues in this senatorial race. And let's not give Rick Santorum credit. Let's not blame the Green Party. Carl Romanelli put this operation together, and I had the understanding with a handful of Republican friends of mine who helped me that we were both using each other. I needed money because I had none. And I was well aware that they thought that my presence would help their candidate. I didn't ascribe to that point of view, but it was mutual because for 5 years, the Green Party of Pennsylvania has been lobbying our legislature for more fair ballot access and for campaign reforms. It's fallen on deaf ears.
Carl Romanelli, to be clear, the money went to the Laverne County Green Party, which is not a part of the state Green Party?
Correct. That was another one of the complications. We needed this enormous amount of signatures, and the Pennsylvania Green Party was not even registered as a federal party PAC. Initially, I was going to try to raise as much money as I could and turn it over to the state party for the ballot access drive. But without having a vessel to take money for federal candidates, I took it upon myself to use our local, which performed the task of the task normally performed by a state party. And also, all of the money that I collected from the Republican donors did go, as you pointed out, to the Luzerne County Green Party. This didn't go to my campaign. This was solely for ballot access and then later to try to pay for defense of our signatures.
We only have 10 seconds,
but
would you do it?
Republican money is a problem, which I knew there would be controversy once we filed our first financial report. But I also wanted the coverage to be fair. Bob Casey has taken far more Republican money than I have. He's taken it from Republican PACs like PNC and
Carl Romanelli, we're going to have to leave it there.
Blank Rome LLP.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you very much for joining us. Carl Romanelli joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrufo Dukaduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Happy Halloween. I'm Amy Goodman.